Hi, and welcome back to the Unseen Podcast, a podcast dedicated to missing people, unresolved cases, and UK true crime. Today we've got a special episode, and one that needs to be told. Kyle Clark was just 27 when he was killed on the night of January the 10th, 2017. The circumstances surrounding his death have been often misinterpreted, and sadly the outcome has been that Kyle's death has not been addressed in the manner that it should have been. I spoke to Helen, his mum, for this episode, who provided me with lots of information about who Kyle was and the family's own tragic set of circumstances. In this episode, I interviewed Jen Jarvie, who we've spoken to before on this podcast. I talked to Jen about the technicalities surrounding Kyle's case and what is being done to bring his story more to the forefront. We touch on many important topics, including the stigma still attached to sexual assault cases, and the problematic nature of the citizen's arrest law. This episode contains descriptions that some listeners may find distressing, including a description of a sexual assault. We don't go into graphic detail, but if this is something that may be upsetting to you, please use your discretion. Kyle's case is inextricably linked to an awful assault that happened to his mum, Helen. I initially spoke to Jen about Helen's determination to right the wrongs that have happened to her family and how she's helping the family to raise awareness.
I think it's sort of double-sided as well. I think it's one of these cases that isn't very well known as mm-hmm. well. It's obviously the Mark Shirley side of it. And the Kyle side of it is just unbelievable. It's one of these things that even one of those things happening to a family is horrendous. But to have it happen to this same lady and she's still so, you know, determined to help others as well, which is absolutely, it's adorable, really, you know, mm-hmm. because I don't know many people who would actually be that strong. So, you know, it's a testament to it. And the family, they are so close-knit. When they come up to obviously to discuss anything with me about either case, it's not just Helen that comes, it's the whole family, which is unusual, which is mm-hmm. lovely as well, lovely for that they've all got that really tight knit support.
That was the impression I got about Helen, how strong and how, you know, determined she was to carry, you know, to get this story out there and to make sure. Yeah. To make sure it does, like you say, does help other people. It's not just for herself; it's for other people as well.
This is just it. It's and I think even both sides of it, you know, she's been even the kids, you know, not kids but the young adults have been her children have been so brave over it, you know, mm-hmm. and Richard obviously keeping everybody together, you know, so it's lovely to see a family unit that after such a horrendous thing to happen, mm-hmm. even that obviously the incident with Mark Shirley, never mind. Obviously what happened with Kyle, that it's so often, you know, families break down and things like that. And this is a family that's actually, you know, so close that it's actually, from my sort of viewpoint, it's nice to see that it mm-hmm. goes against the grain in that respect.
I then asked Jen how she got involved with Helen and Kyle's cases.
Well, I met Helen online. We had a mutual, I wouldn't say interest, but we sort of were part of the same groups. Obviously, Helen as a victim and a victim's family, obviously taking the two incidents into account, and myself, obviously, because, you know, I was offering help to others as I do. And I came across Helen's case initially, obviously, about her son, Kyle. And my son is was at the time a similar age to Kyle when his incident happened. And I kind of thought, well, you know, as a mother, you've got to kind of put yourself in that position that what would you do? Would you accept that kind of justice, or would you want to know more? Would you want to actually say, hang on a minute, you know, he was a vulnerable young lad. And I approached Helen and we met, we spoke at length, and, you know, we speak most every other day now. And that's lovely. You know, that's lovely because she has grown to trust me. And obviously I know that, you know, we can talk about both aspects of a case. And you know, in both respects, help her, but in different ways. So, and obviously I've met the family as well, which is really important to me, that, you know, that you see that cohesion. So you get to actually know, you get to know the victimology of Helen, although she would never like to be referred to as a victim, and Kyle as obviously a victim. I see it as being, you know, the final victim of Mark Shirley in a sort of metaphorical way. Obviously, the case of Mark Shirley dates right back to 1985, and shortly after, obviously, his conviction in 1987 for Mary Wainwright. And then he obviously disappears, you know, he goes to prison, he disappears from society, which is, you know, which is a safer place. When he obviously is, and I say rehabilitated, when the parole board thinks he's rehabilitated, he's let back into society and the cycle starts again. And obviously, unfortunately, meets Helen. Through a friend, through where she was living, and subjected Helen to the most horrific attack. And there is no beating around the bush with it. You know, it was an absolutely horrendous attack in her own home. And one thing we've got to remember is in your own home, you feel the most safe, the most secure. It's where you can be you. Without any pretense at all, you know, and that goes for every walk of life. So for her to actually have this happen in her own home, it is horrendous. Obviously, as part of that, and them being such a close-knit family, it affected each and every one of her children in different ways. And obviously, one of them was Kyle. And that obviously led on to Kyle being vulnerable, and, you know, we are all vulnerable in different ways.
Mark Shirley, who carried out the assault on Helen, is a convicted murderer and rapist, and had met Helen through a friend of hers. Jen told me a little more about his background and Helen's awful ordeal.
Going right the way back to Mary Wainwright, he reenacts with Helen his previous crimes and refers to her as Mary. So when he goes back to that original crime, he was 16 years old and he brutally assaulted Mary Wainwright. He used a knife on Mary Wainwright and actually left that with her. Now, not in her, but with her. The wounds that he inflicted were beyond question horrific. And obviously this shocked, obviously, the community there. He was very quickly apprehended. But when he was released on parole and eventually did meet Helen, and Helen was cleaning, she was just doing her normal cleaning in a house, and she had obviously a lot of kids that had gone to, she'd take them to school. It was a chance for her to do a cleaning, you know, in peace and quiet. And she came downstairs and he was in her kitchen. Now, she knew Mark, so did think that, you know, what are you doing here? You know, why are you here? And obviously from there, a 5.5 hour attack occurred in her own home. Mark Shirley, Mark Shirley raped her, brutally raped her, and subjected her to a torturous event that went on for 5.5 hours. Now, after that 5.5 hour point, her son comes back and obviously interrupts what's going on. And throughout this 5.5 hour attack, he refers to various different victims that he has encountered over the years, including Mary, referring to them as his angels, which has a real sinister tone to it anyway. So he's interrupted, and Helen obviously gets redressed. He makes her get redressed and acts as though there is nothing wrong at all. I'll go back to during the attack in a moment, but he has a conversation with her son. He then leaves, and Helen is left there to comprehend what's happened, but obviously also comprehend the fact that she was lucky to be alive. She knows him, so he's very quickly apprehended. And when he is apprehended, it all starts to unfold. So everything that he's told her during that attack of seven victims turns out to be accurate. So he refers to when he first came out of parole, and obviously out of prison, and he was on parole, he meets a lady in the Piano and Pitcher. It's a pub. It's late at night. He meets a lady there and starts chatting to her. This is a very enigmatic man. He's very he's good looking. He's able to speak to ladies. So, you know, there was nothing alarming about him. And she speaks to him for a bit at the bar, and then he steps over a mark, and she gets very annoyed and leaves. And he follows her home and stalks her for 3 weeks. So she has no idea about this, stalks her for 3 weeks, and then reenacts obviously what he did with Mary Wainwright. He breaks in the middle of the night and attacks her. And although he doesn't murder her, he carries out the most heinous attacks, so much so that until Helen's case came about and she waived her right to anonymity, this lady kept completely silent. She didn't want to obviously let anybody know what had happened because she was terrified he would come back, and which is what he'd said he would do. So during Helen's attack, obviously she hears about this. So she knows there is somebody out there, but obviously with these kind of cases, it's always very difficult if you don't have a deceased victim, because obviously there is still a huge stigma about coming forward, about rape attacks and things like that. Mm-hmm. So obviously at this point, Helen waives her anonymity, and obviously it all comes out with the second victim. However, there are more. There are other victims that during the attack, it was this very similar modus operandi, signature, if you like, that Mark Shirley did. And that was placing pennies or money on his victims. This is some form of religious ritualistic fetish that he had. It was coins that he placed in the palms. With Helen, he was searching rapidly for two pence pieces to put on her. Mm-hmm. It was a common thing. So, in fact, was drinking the blood of his victims. Certainly with Mary Wainwright, that was quite evident. Also, during these attacks, this isn't a continuous attack in the sense of continuously with them. He steps away and makes a cup of tea and does these normal functions, these sort of everyday, very ordinary functions, and then returns to his victim, who is absolutely terrified, and continues with the attack. So it's almost like a tea break he takes, which shows how sinister and psychopathic this man actually is.
It sounds very dismissive as well, doesn't it? You know, I'm just gonna move on now, get on with this, as if it's just an everyday occurrence. Yeah. Which is
and what you've got to bear in mind is his partner at the time, who he was engaged to, who, you know, was it had no idea. No idea that the severity of his previous crimes. She was told by Shirley that he basically had been with others. They'd run away. He'd taken the blame. He'd copped for everything, and he really dumbed it down to her and made it almost justifying what he did. And she obviously cared for him. She had no reason not to. So she accepted that version of events. And it was only obviously when Helen's case came out that it was, well, actually, that's not the case. And we do know that the victims, or the angels, as he refers to them, we can account for so many of them, but there is others that we can't account for yet. And that's obviously where I've gone in to help Helen and obviously other victims of that crime, which would remain anonymous, to help in the sense of his very first victim, which he obviously described to Helen as being when he was 14.
It's very, very, you're right about the stigma as well, isn't it, of people?
Yeah.
It's very difficult, and so it's brave, you know, that Helen decided to come forward, and I think it speaks to her character, doesn't it, that she wants to come forward and, you know, tell people about what happened.
Absolutely. And bear in mind, obviously she was so in shock when this happened that she didn't tell Richard straight away. I think it took her a while to get the words and to get that process together in her own head. And I can't really blame her for that, because this was, no rape is better than another by any means. But this was, as I say, in her own home. It was somebody she knew. It was somebody who, you know, subjected her to the most horrendous attack. And she even went to pick her kids up from school that day in the same clothes that she was wearing at the time. You know, she was. It was almost like autopilot. Now, obviously, it's better for any woman who's gone through any form of sexual assault. There is always the stigma that has come from the 80s, unfortunately, and 80s policing, where are they going to believe me? Are they going to think I was responsible? There's all sorts of psychological reasons why people don't come forward. They're shamed. You know, they don't want their family or friends to know about it, or partners. You know, so there's lots. And this is with male and female victims as well. So, you know, we need to be very aware that, you know, this isn't just a female crime or a female stigma. That police forces are getting better. They're getting more training in sexual assaults and how to deal with victims. But there is still that that issue. And, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately for Shirley's victims, Helen came forward and waived that right to say, hang on a minute, you know, this has happened to me. And the effect, obviously, that it had on a family. And little did she know when that happened, obviously, what was going to happen afterwards with her son.
Jen explained how Kyle and the whole family was affected by what happened to Helen, and told me how this had an impact on him in particular.
Obviously, with Kyle, what we've got to bear in mind is that they were, all of his siblings were so tight knit, and he took it really, you know, took it really badly. You know, he was very close to his mum. Very close to his siblings and his dad. And for something like that to happen and think, actually, you know, I'm the young lad, I'm the male, you know, I should have been able to protect my mum. And unfortunately, that led Kyle down a road of a bit of self-destruction, you know, where he got in a bad crowd, and, you know, he did a few things that, you know, he maybe shouldn't have done. But I think we all as adults have gone through that stage as young adults, that rebellious stage, that sort of, you know, learning about the world stage. And unfortunately, Cal just got into a bad crowd and was vulnerable. And this is really important that to note that even the police officer at the time who came to see Kyle said, you know, he's a vulnerable young man. Vulnerability strategies now are different. Then they didn't put that strategy in place for him. And Kyle wanted to pay back, you know, a debt and got in with the wrong crowd. And no matter all of the support in the world from his family, you know, he had that same stoic determination that his mum has to put things right. And unfortunately, in the process, Kyle lost his life.
It's just so sad that that's kind of the, you know, it all had a snowball effect, didn't it? You know, dealing with that as a family and knowing how to move forward. And, you know, obviously they were all going to be affected by it, you know, by such an traumatic event. So I don't know, do you want to tell me about some of the events leading up to Kyle's death?
So Kyle had got in with a bad crowd and accumulated a drug debt. And people cope with things in different ways, different ways, some with alcohol, some with prescription drugs, some with, you know, non-prescription drugs. Unfortunately, with Kyle, he got into this bad crowd and the way he coped, and this is not with judgment, me saying this, but the way he coped, he accumulated a drug debt. And I've spoken to, obviously, his sister and his mum, and they've said, you know, we offered to pay it back for him, but he wanted to pay that back himself. And he had a job. He'd started to get things, you know, back on track. Dad had bought him a car. And as part of this, Kyle, this bad crowd that Kyle got into, was part of that drug debt. And on the night in question, Kyle was party to bilking, which is going to a garage and stealing fuel. Now, the family, you know, aren't condoning that, you know, at all. But the circumstances of what happened that night have to be taken in context. And Kyle drives, is driving the vehicle, and Shackle Islam is in the passenger seat. Now, this isn't his friend. This isn't Kyle's friend. This is more a transaction between the two of them. But they aren't friends. And they both drive into the garage. Obviously, he's in the passenger seat, Kyle's driving. Kyle gets out of the vehicle. And I've seen the CCTV footage in full, by the way, of this. So this isn't just hearsay. This is fact. He gets out of the vehicle, just like any young lad would, and goes round and starts to fill up his car. There's nothing unusual about that. Nothing at all. It could be, you know, my son filling up his car. It could be any of your listeners filling up their car at a garage. You know, there was nothing remarkable about it. As he starts to, obviously, he fills up his car and then goes to fill a jerry can up in the boot, which again, it could be for a multitude of different things. It could be because, you know, he's gone on a long journey. It could be for a petrol lawnmower. It could be for a motorbike. There's all sorts of reasons why he might have done that. But again, there's nothing extraordinary about it. At this point, and I've got to refer to him legally as the garage worker. So we'll refer to him as that. The garage worker comes out of the garage onto the forecourt, and Kyle panics. Because this guy is a big guy, and he's running towards Kyle. So Kyle puts the nozzle back and goes to hit the driver's side of the car. Now, this isn't necessarily to drive off. You know, this is his bank card is in the car. He doesn't know why this very large man is running towards him. Now, he's running towards him with a can of soup in his hand, which obviously is visible on the CCTV footage. A struggle ensues, and during that struggle, Kyle he doesn't fight back. He doesn't. He puts his hands up in defence. He doesn't attempt to hit the man. He doesn't attempt to kick him. He literally, you know, this is a young lad, a young vulnerable lad, and he's struck 6 times on his head with that can. And we've seen the CCTV footage of it above his head, and they're making contact with Kyle. And at this point, there's a big struggle going on. It's sort of been almost ragdolled around the forecourt. He tries to get back into the vehicle. He's pulled back out again. The passenger is injured during that as well. He's then dragged onto the forecourt. And the garage worker, in his court statement, said, "Boy's asleep on the floor." He wasn't asleep. I think I will leave it to the listeners to kind of work out, you know, put two and two together as to what was going on there. At this point, Chakram, he gets into the driver's seat. He climbs over into the driver's seat and drives off. Now, he swerves to miss the garage worker and obviously drives off the forecourt. And obviously, once the car has moved away, there is no Kyle on the forecourt. The garage worker shrugs his shoulders and picks up 2 items from the forecourt, garage forecourt, and goes back into the garage. What the driver is not aware of, and I genuinely believe that it was never something that they wanted to do, there was never any intent there to do that, he's actually scooped Kyle up on the forecourt, and he drives with him for about 0.5 mile. And then he's finally flagged down. And obviously, when Kyle's body is actually removed from underneath the vehicle, despite several attempts with different medical intervention, Kyle dies. And it's absolutely tragic. And it's, you know, it's dealt with as an accident, as manslaughter. However, no charges whatsoever are brought towards the garage worker. And it was deemed, and I use that in the loosest sense, it was deemed that the garage worker used a Section 24 of PACE for a citizen's arrest that has to be proportionate, and it has to be obviously, you know, it has to be proportionate to the crime that was happening. I just want to reiterate that Kyle was filling up his car. He had just a little car, and it was £34 worth of petrol that he had means to pay for. The 2 items that were picked up on the forecourt were Kyle's phone and Kyle's bank card, which have never been recovered. And we have the CCTV footage of this. This isn't just assumption. This is witnessed by a witness over the other side of the pumps who actually witnesses all of this going on. And unfortunately, the Stockfords are left with so many unanswered questions as to how much justice has actually been achieved. Obviously, Chakram Islam has been released from prison now. He was released about 6 months ago. He served about 2.5 years. For a life, which I think in anybody's eyes leaves a very, very bitter taste. But obviously the garage worker has, because obviously he was deemed to be a victim, I'll just repeat that, he was deemed to be a victim, that unfortunately, legally, there is no redress at all.
It really is a horrific story. And I think, obviously, I haven't seen the full CCTV, but I have seen parts of it that have been publicized, you know, that are in the newspapers. Yes. And even that, to me, is...
Yeah.
Is, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because you can see that he is dragged around the forecourt, and you can also see that there isn't a conversation beforehand. And I think that's what struck me, that he wasn't spoken to first. There was no sort of, you know, what are you doing? You know,
are you, young lad, don't steal my fuel, or are you going to pay for that? Or there was absolutely no interaction at all. And there's footages online at the Bristol Post. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, it can be viewed, not all of it. And obviously, I've seen it in its entirety, and it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking to watch. I think what's even worse was that could be anyone who's filling up fuel. You know, one thing we had to consider was that obviously Richard had bought the vehicle for Kyle only about a week or so before. Was it, you know, mistaken identity? Was it, you know, and these were all of the things that we had to look at. You know, did they think it was somebody else? You know, was Kyle, you know, identified by his vehicle? And I think that was the case. And it was that he was identified by a vehicle that had previously been involved with Bilkin.
One of the parts of this case that shocked me was that Kyle had been attacked with no evidence that he was involved with stealing fuel. The assumption had just been made that he probably was. Jen went on to tell me more about this.
So it could be anybody. And if, you know, we look at, you know, that Richard bought the car for Kyle only a week prior. So, you know, it is, the chances are that they would identify the vehicle as being perhaps one that had been involved previously in some kind of bilking or some kind of theft. Theft is obviously under the Theft Act, you know, we're talking, it's a completely different crime to, you know, your murder, your manslaughter, and certainly a very different crime to grievous bodily harm or offences against the person, which obviously is what happened. Because he had been swerved at, as obviously standing on the forecourt, he was classed as a victim. So you can't be a victim and an offender, apparently, in the eyes of the law at the same time. I disagree. There are plenty of serial killers, for example, who are victims and offenders at the same time, you know, victims of various different other things. I think what is really indicative is the fact that Kyle was, in his own words, the garage worker, was asleep, boy asleep on the forecourt. And this is testimony, so it is public record. Now, could we actually, even, you know, in our wildest imagination, think that Kyle was asleep on that forecourt? You know, had Chakram, for instance, reversed his car rather than gone forward, would the outcome have been the same? You know, would we still be here talking about Kyle in the past tense?
I told Jen that I was surprised by the CCTV footage, as before the man grabs Kyle, it appears that no conversation is had about what he's doing, and he already seems ready for a fight.
It literally, he runs, he comes out, he stands, he looks, he takes that judgment, and then he attacks Kyle. There is no two ways about it. And this isn't an assumption. And I want to reiterate to everybody, you know, this isn't just eyewitness testimony that can, you know, can be inaccurate at times. This is CCTV footage. And we can actually, you know, we presented this, unfortunately, to Avon and Somerset, and they did a review, and they found that that was proportionate and that was okay. I just wonder how proportionate it is to hit a young man six times. And we have literally the frame by frame. Helen sent me 14,000 stills of the CCTV footage. So, you know, we have it literally, and it is, I hate the phrase, but blow by blow. And, you know, we have a can of soup held high above his head, and then a can of soup that's in his hand making contact with Kyle's skull. Now, I don't know anybody that wouldn't be unconscious rather than asleep. I would like to think that if that were the case, that Kyle wouldn't have felt anything. He wouldn't have felt a thing. And that's the only comfort you can bring from that at all. There is very little comfort that you can bring legally, unfortunately, and it is tragic. That could be anybody's son. It could be anybody's partner. It could be anybody's, you know, dad. It's as simple as that.
I think it's worrying that, you know, in terms of what happened, that that was deemed proportionate to hit someone over the head multiple times with a weapon, essentially. That's deemed as proportionate. That, to me, isn't what you would do, especially if you don't have the grounds, really, to be doing it.
It's a disproportionate response. I think we have to look at other cases, and I don't take any gratification of comparing any cases when you have such polar opposite. But, you know, the Christopher Donovan case, for example, he was tragically killed. He had an altercation with a group of young men one night. There was obviously two of them there, and Christopher was hit. He was then in the middle of the road, and obviously at that point, a young lady in a car came along, didn't realise, again, same kind of attitude, scooped poor Christopher up, and was absolutely traumatised by doing that, which, you know, is totally understandable. And that lady was treated as a victim, as a witness, was never treated as a suspect. And obviously the initial attack on Christopher, that's what was looked at, and rightfully so. And through the fantastic work of Colin Sutton, they actually got justice with that, which is fantastic for the family, absolutely fantastic. And what a lovely family that I've seen and read that they are. Now, they came from a really nice background. You know, Christopher wouldn't be classed as vulnerable. And I've got to ask myself, you know, that if you have Kyle, who is vulnerable, and that perhaps, you know, is being led down a darker path, has he been treated differently because of that, you know, because of that vulnerability?
And it seems, unfortunately, that it's been boiled down to, well, we thought he was stealing, and this is what happened. You know, it's as if those two things are the only parts of the story. And I think I was shocked and surprised by the things that Helen told me, you know, that you've just told me about the other parts of the story that I don't think get enough attention.
They don't, because what they look at is, oh, well, he was stealing fuel. Well, no, this is just it. Theft, you have to permanently deprive somebody of something. Where bilking is concerned, it's when you drive off the forecourt, you know, and even then there is a level of sort of a proportionality about it. However, you know, Helen and his elder sister Amy, who is absolutely adorable, and Amy, you know, said to me that she used to help Kyle with the mom, and, you know, to manage his finances, so he didn't have a lot of money in his bank, and his wages and things like that, in case obviously he succumbed to temptation or anything like that, that they would just say, he would just ring them up and say, oh, I need, you know, 20 quid, I need £10, I need £5 for my lunch or whatever. And they would just transfer it. And having seen Kyle's bank statements, this was a regular thing. You know, it was a regular thing that they did. So even if the garage worker had said, you're going to steal that fuel, he had a bank card on him, he had his mobile phone on him, it would have been one phone call and the fuel would have been paid for. You know, if he'd been caught red-handed, you know, even if he'd been caught red-handed leaving the forecourt, he would have still had the means to pay. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because the garage worker is seen picking up the bank card, he's seen picking up the mobile phone that have come loose from Kyle as he's been pulled around. And when I say pulled around, his shirt is pulled up over his head. Mm-hmm. You know, he's pulled around like a rag doll on the forecourt. That they've never been handed in, they've never been recovered. They have disappeared into the ether. So that looks as though there is no means to pay. Unfortunately, you know, that wasn't the case. And with bank statements that I've seen, that I have possession of, obviously can back that up, that this was a regular thing that they would do that.
So how much did the police, would you say, actually investigate, or how much did they just kind of go with that narrative that Kyle must have been stealing and that's what happened? Because I'm surprised that more emphasis wasn't put on the fact that he was hit and he was attacked, yeah, really, yeah, before, yeah, that happened.
It's unbelievable to think this, you know, this actually, you know, has happened. And when I first heard, I thought, no, there must have been something, you know, there must have been some interaction, there must have been, Cal must have said something, done something. And when I've seen the full footage, it's just not the case. And so my first, you know, thing was, well, he's been assaulted, he's been, you know, there is no proportionality with that. And prior to me coming and helping Helen and Richard and the family, they had issued an IOPC complaint about the way that they'd been treated. And I think this was kind of a sort of catalogue of things. Now, bearing in mind, this is the same force that has dealt with Helen only a few years prior. So they know who she is. They know what she's gone through. They know that her and her family are vulnerable. You know, they are aware of this. Yet, they obviously, they take, in my mind, a slightly more easier approach and an easier conviction, because obviously Shackrell's, well, you know, I was driving, didn't mean to do it. But there is a bigger picture than that, you know, and I think it's a real shame. It's an absolute travesty. Because that real justice that we strive to uphold in this country, you know, and we are lucky to have the legal system that we have in this country, has let them down. And I think, you know, that Kyle was a vulnerable young man, and actually what he needed was a vulnerability strategy intervention, you know, to cushion him, to get him through that. And sadly, when things did go wrong, he was let down again. And all because of, and I think this sort of stemmed from the Mark Shirley incident and obviously what the family went through. And that's why, to my mind, you know, he's Mark Shirley's final victim, indirectly.
And I think when I, you know, listen to Helen talk about it, I was thinking, as a parent, I would not let that drop either, because there are no answers. You know, it's kind of come to an end, and it's like, well, it's done. You know, the case is closed, but it's not, because there are so many other questions about why things weren't investigated, why things have not been brought up, you know, in the course of it. And I wouldn't be able to let it drop either. So I really do. You're not blame Helen for wanting to
admire her. You've got to admire somebody that, you know, even when we've actually put this to the police, and we have given them, and when I say a blow by blow, I mean still number X amount shows the can above the garage worker's head, still XYZ shows the can making contact with his head. And we have six of those. We have six sets. And we presented that to the constabulary and said, hang on a minute, you're really missing something here. And they said that they would no longer, the guy who dealt with it, the officer, really, really nice officer, and I have full admiration for the jobs that he's done previously and since. But he said, you know, that this wouldn't be dealt with again, and, you know, it wouldn't be reviewed again. And as a mother, and a mother of a son of a similar age, I just can't get my head around how Helen gets up on the morning with that lack of what we called when I first met her was true justice. You know, when the chap who accidentally, and it was accidentally, you know, runs over and kills your child, 2.5 years later, he is freed. He, as far as I'm aware, he is back in prison for a different reason. But 2.5 years later, that isn't even enough time for grief to set in, for a family to kind of get their heads around it. You know, he was a deeply, deeply loved member of that family. And he had his 32nd birthday, or would have, last week. And a couple of weeks ago, and the outpouring of love from his family was just heartbreaking to read, you know, on Facebook and things like that, because after he's left a huge hole, you know, with them. And you know, he was a loved brother and a loved son.
Helen's family have been through a lot, and I told Jen that it must be difficult for them to hear that there's nothing that can be done in Kyle's case.
I think it's not because we were sort of insinuating that a certain action had happened. You know, we weren't sort of saying, well, hang on a minute, I've spoken as an investigator, I've spoken to a witness, and they have told me. This is first-hand CCTV footage. You know, it can't get any more clear and any more sort of an overall view of exactly what happened, and a very unbiased view as to what happened. And when it's broken down, you know, it's unbelievable that citizens' arrests, for a start off, can be so disproportionate, because it isn't the only citizens' arrest that's happened in Bristol and the surrounding area, where it's been questioned as to what is proportionate. Well, proportionate does not include hitting somebody with, you know, what is in effect a weapon. If that had been a knife, or if that had been a hammer, you know, we would be treating it exactly the same. You know, if the guy had been putting up shelves or whatever, he was stacking shelves, but he still struck him 6 times. And that kind of disproportionality of a citizen's arrest is it's shocking. It's shocking. And I would encourage others to, you know, have a look at the CCTV footage, the clips that are on the Bristol Post website, and make their own judgment.
Yeah. And I think the idea of citizen's arrest is sometimes quite a grey area. It's not something that people really know a lot about, is it? Yeah. And it can sometimes get miscommunicated that, you know, a citizen's arrest is you can kind of do whatever you want. Obviously, that isn't what it is.
Yeah, that isn't the case. The main key area here is proportionality. So the proportionate force that needs to be used, you know, if Kyle had been fighting back, then yes, you would have expected more force than, you know, the necessary, but you wouldn't have expected a weapon. If Kyle had had the can of soup in his hand, then you would have expected a very aggressive approach from somebody, obviously to get that can of soup off him. When you watch the footage, you will notice that Kyle is in defense mode completely. He puts his hands up, you know, and his palms to the sky kind of thing. He's surrendering. He doesn't punch back. He doesn't kick back. He literally is trying to get into the car to get his a bank card to pay for the fuel, to his phone, obviously probably to phone his family. Mm-hmm. And instead, he is repeatedly struck. And this footage is out there to see.
The CCTV footage in this case is pivotal, and it is distressing, but crucial to understanding what actually happened that night.
I was going to say, if you look at it as well, you know, what would you do in that situation if someone came out in an aggressive manner towards you? Yeah. You would want to try and protect yourself and get in the car.
You know, let's be honest, Kyle was not a sort of strongly built lad. He was a very average, if anything, slightly sort of slim build. He wasn't sort of, you know, he didn't spend hours at the gym, you know, and look aggressive or any, you know, he just didn't. And if that were you or I, or if that were, you know, the listener, and they were, the next time they go to the garage and fill up their car, I would love for the listeners to actually just think, what would I do in that case, in that scenario, if somebody came running towards me with a can of soup held high above the head when he's running towards him, and you know, and you know that they're coming towards you, what would you do? And I think your fight or flight would take into would come into being. He puts the nozzle back. He wants to get away, not because he's stealing fuel, but because there is a great, you know, there's a guy that must have 5 or 6 stone, the heavier than him. He's taller than him. And, you know, that's a guesstimation, by the way, but you can get the sort of general proportions between the two. You know, this is a big guy who's coming towards him with a can of soup held high in his hand. He doesn't have it in his hand, you know, at waist height. He has it above his head. He is coming towards him, and I think anybody in Kyle's position would panic. I think anybody in Kyle's position would want to get away. And anybody in Kyle's position would be unconscious on the forecourt. And like I said before, that is my only, that's to me as a mother, that's the only thing that I can say, that, you know, I hope he was unconscious on the forecourt because of what happened next. Because he wouldn't have felt anything. If he was unconscious, he wouldn't have felt anything. And I just pray, literally pray to God that that was the case.
Jen has expressed the importance of watching the CCTV to better understand this case, and I will link it in the show notes.
I think it's important to note as well that garage worker comes out for about two or three metres. He stops. He takes in what's happening, and then... So he is very aware of what he's doing. And at this point, bearing in mind, all Carl's doing is filling his car up and filling up a jerry can in the backseat. You know, if he was going to steal fuel, you know, we can't say that he wasn't. And there is a likelihood that he was. You know, we're not sort of shying away from that. But, you know, we would then be looking at the garage worker phoning the police and saying, registration number, he's just stolen some fuel, you know, and then Cal would have taken the punishment that he would have deserved for theft. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure there are people out there who've driven away off forecourt and not paid for fuel because they've just been having a really stressful day and they've forgotten to pay. These things happen. But what you wouldn't expect, and at this point, he hasn't stolen any fuel. He hasn't committed any offence. you wouldn't expect somebody to come towards you and attack you. And if that hadn't have happened, Cal would still be here today because he wouldn't have been on the forecourt. Obviously, if the car had reversed and gone out of the forecourt the other way and not had contact with Kyle, there is no guarantee he wouldn't be here today either because of, you know, because of his injuries. And that's, it's heartbreaking, heartbreaking.
When I spoke to Helen, she told me about how she wants to raise awareness of citizens' arrest and what it actually means when applying to situations like Kyle's. Jen told me her opinion and the importance of the word proportionate.
What is proportionate? What one person sees as being proportionate is different to what another sees as being proportionate. If you believe genuinely that you are, you know, that somebody's coming towards you and they're going to attack you, it's only proportionate that if you do that citizen's arrest, you know, that you're in fear of your life or you're in fear of being assaulted or you know, whatever. I think that idea of proportionality, it's the same as grief. We all grieve differently and we all perceive grief differently. And no one grief is the same. It's the same with proportionality. My idea of proportionate is probably different to yours and different to, you know, maybe several listeners. One thing that I hope that we would all agree on is that running out of a garage with a can of soup in your hand and your hand held high, ready to attack somebody without provocation, without communication, without even a warning of, I am going to arrest you under the citizen's arrest policy of Pace, Section 24, even if they didn't know what that was, you know, even if they just said, look, I'm going to make a citizen's arrest. I don't think that that would be proportionate coming out with, you know, a weapon held high. I would be terrified, you know, and I don't think anybody would say that it would be disproportionate not to feel terrified, not to want to get away. Why would Cal be any different? There was no act of communication between the two. You know, there was nothing to say that, you know, that garage worker wasn't fearing for his life. You know, he maybe didn't know what Cal would have done. But what we have to remember is that it was their company policy not to go onto the forecourt. Mm-hmm. You know, it's their company policy not mm-hmm. to do that. And, you know, as soon as he comes onto the forecourt, you know, we still don't have a crime that's been committed. The first crime that's actually committed is, to my mind and to the Stockford's mind, is when Kyle is repeatedly struck by somebody far stronger, far taller, far heavier, with a weapon in his hand. And, you know, what that garage worker should have done was ring the police and tell them, have Kyle arrested, because at that point he would have committed that crime because he would have left the forecourt. At that point, and I would urge people to watch that CCTV footage, he is attacked whilst he actually rushes round to put the nozzle back in the petrol pump. You know, Kyle could have used that as a weapon. He could, you know, he has petrol. He has an endless supply of petrol there. That wasn't the case. He wasn't in any way threatening. And what he did do was fill up his car with about £34 worth of fuel. And there's, you know, the jerry can in the boot. And I would urge, you know, any of the listeners, next time they're at the garage, just think about Kyle.
And I will link the CCTV, all the articles that have CCTV in, because I think it really gives you a sense of what was going on.
Yeah, I think what's really important is for people not to think, you know, oh, her son was a wrong one. He was doing something he shouldn't have been doing, and he got, you know, he got what he deserved. Because that's absolutely not the case, and it is kind of how it was reported to begin with.
And I was going to say, you know, if you do have a cursory glance at some of the articles, that is the way it does feel. You know, yeah. You have to really dig a little bit deeper to go, oh, right. And it makes you then question what they'd initially made it sound like, that he was stealing, and that's what happened to him.
And what we've got to bear in mind is that, you know, the vulnerable in our society, it doesn't matter which city you live in, you know, we all have vulnerable people in our society, and it's how we treat our vulnerable, the vulnerable people. It really is a measure of how we are as a society, as a whole. And this is a lad whose family had been horrendously torn apart. Don't forget, this guy lived next door. He knew Kyle. You know, Kyle knew who he was. You know, Kyle had to get his head around this. He had to get his head around the fact that his mum had been brutally assaulted, brutally raped, and could have been murdered. That's the long and short of it. You know, that could have been the case. And, you know, he needed professional support, that, you know, his mum and his family were giving him every bit of support that they could. But, you know, they're not experts in that form of rehabilitation. Who is? You know, and it could be anybody's son. And it's just heartbreaking to think that not only did, you know, this happen to him, but it happened to him, you know, obviously at a later date when he was at the garage. But then afterwards, that he hasn't had that true justice.
This is such a crucial part of the story, and one we need to remember. I told Jen that one thing that sticks with me about this case is that this could have happened to anyone. Kyle was just an ordinary person visiting the petrol station. This fact has nothing to do with his background or the bad crowd that he had got involved with.
And I think when you look at sort of the Christopher Donovan case, you know, that just goes to show that, you know, your background and vulnerability doesn't make you impregnable to, you know, any kind of tragedy. You know, I think the way that case was handled was absolutely fantastically done. And, you know, they were able to actually piece together the two elements of, you know, of Christopher's death. And the same aspects happened with this one, that you had an assault and then obviously the issue with the car. And it's very difficult to kind of cross-reference which injury came from where. And, you know, it's just tragic, absolutely tragic, that, you know, this family have to go through that, but then know that what happens about the next young man that goes to the garage, or, you know, this garage worker comes across. His idea of proportionality is very different to mine, you know. And he remains, obviously, with the anonymity that we are giving him. Obviously, his name is out there, but we are giving him that anonymity, because, you know, the Stockfords are good people. Yeah. And so hopefully, you know, the more awareness of citizens' arrests, more awareness of vulnerability and vulnerable people in our neighbourhood and society, you know, and having that link between, you know, community strategies and victims as well. You know, I would like to think somebody out there might, you know, might look and go, well, actually, you know, we need to use this and look into this further. I actually use this case to teach prospective police officers, because I think it's one of the most ideal cases to show how it's gone wrong. You know, the way that I teach this to begin with is to say, okay, this is how it was initially reported. You know, who's vulnerable here, who's the victim, and we then backtrack, obviously, to the Mark Shirley case, so they're aware as to, oh, hang on a minute, and then we look back at Kyle and we say, hang on, you know, who is vulnerable here? And they all realise, obviously, that the vulnerability isn't always as obvious as you know. You don't wear a big sticker saying I'm vulnerable, but they knew Kyle was vulnerable. You know, they knew Kyle was vulnerable, and they knew the family were vulnerable as well. And, you know, that's bad enough, but to have him treated in such a way, is unbelievable.
I told Jen that I hope when people know of all the facts of the case, then it can be looked at in a different way, so that Kyle's family can get answers.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I just sort of wonder, you know, that the Stratfords get some form of justice. As it stands at the moment, the police won't look into it any further. But perhaps, you know, the public can make their own mind up and have a look at the footage. You know the story now. You know what happened to him and what brought Kyle to being on that forecourt in the first place. Not that that excuses his actions if he was going to, you know, commit an offence. But at the point of that attack, he hadn't. And he was, you know, a victim all over again. It's one of these cases that will never be solved, and you will never get that kind of resolve, because that guy is protected and is a victim. And I just find that a bit of a bitter pill to swallow.
I want to thank Helen and Jen for speaking to me for this episode, and I would really encourage you to watch the CCTV and make up your own mind about what happened. To me, it's clear that regardless of Kyle's previous history and what he'd got himself into, what happened to him was unacceptable. I've been shocked by what I've heard in this case, and I hope everyone feels that this could have happened to anyone we know, and that shouldn't be okay. I want to thank our patrons for all their support, and anyone that leaves us a review is very much appreciated. If you want to get in touch with feedback, case suggestions or tips, contact me on social media or at theunseenpod@gmail.com. As always, until next time, I'm Caprice, and this has been Unseen.